I think I'm having an art attack.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm so glad we're back. Welcome to another episode of Art Attack with your host, extremely highly intellectual, knowledgeable art historian, genius, Lizzie Dastin, and me, just a guy who paints. I'm just a guy that paints. I'm just a guy, but it's great to be back with you.
Well, one of the greatest living painters, in fact, Justin Bua. So you need to give yourself a proper introduction. And it really is thrilling to be back. I'm so excited that we're going to do this. We're going to habituate it finally and be more consistent. We love having these conversations, and we're not physically in the same place, but that doesn't need to keep us from talking about art. So here we go.
Yeah, we're spiritually in the same place anyway. So
always.
Today, we're going to talk about one of the greatest painters in many ways of our, in the entire history of art. I mean, he's up there. I hate to do this because it's so like Casey Kasem, but like I give him the top 100 of all time, personally.
We say that about a lot of people, but we just have a lot of love and passion for these figures. So I don't disagree.
I get on something, like I get on Manet. And then all of a sudden I go through his oeuvre, his whole collection. And I go, I like him way more than I thought I did. In fact, I think he's so influential, more influential than I ever imagined him to be. You know what I mean? You rediscover somebody, because we've been looking at Manet forever, right? I mean, since I was walking through the Metropolitan, or I'm sure we were exposed to this, these impressionists, Cézanne, Manet, Monet, Degas, Van Gogh, Berthe Morisot, whoever. And he's always been there, but you never think like, how good is he? And so kind of when I went back a little bit of into his works, I started to rediscover how great he was. But why don't you lead us in? Because you're so good at it.
Sure. Well, I completely agree with what you said. I think it's thrilling to get to rediscover or discover for the first time this incredibly influential figure. And often in my teaching, I don't include Manet. I don't have the opportunity to, because he doesn't squarely fit within any one particular movement. And especially when courses are truncated or understandings of movements are pretty limited, then we don't see these figures because they lead us into Impressionism, for instance, or transition us out of realism, as the case of Manet. And I think that these liminal artists are the ones whose careers really need to be examined for many reasons, but certainly including that one. So to situate us contextually, we are in the 1860s in France, and realism is the most popular, sought-after movement. And realists would be artists like Millet, Courbet, and they are painting the everyday man, and a lot of emphasis on working class peasants. And the colors are really muted, they're earthen, and so lots of browns. All the work pretty much was painted in the studio, as is traditional. So that's the work that was common and expected. And then the movement that would happen as a consequence of Manet, I believe, is Impressionism. And all of those paintings are en plein air, painted outside. The color palette has drastically lightened. Now we have the influx of the burgeoning middle class. And so we're moving from a lot of different spheres, from working class to middle class, from darker palettes to lighter palettes, from painting in the studio to painting outside. And Manet, I believe, gets us there. So something that I just wanted to share as part of an introduction to the dichotomy of this figure is that he always wanted the approval of the salon. And the salon was essentially the tastemaker in Paris at the time. And artists would submit their paintings for a review, And if they were accepted, then there was this big exhibition. All the Parisians would come and honor and celebrate your work. And Manet wanted so desperately to be a part of the Salon, but he was rejected. And the French government, led by Napoleon III, they created an exhibition that was across the street called the Salon des Refusés. So basically, all who have been refused by the Salon were exhibiting at the pavilion across the street. And Manet's the work that was so controversial that launched his career that I think we should talk about was exhibited in that 1863 Salon. It's called Luncheon on the Grass.
Okay. Let's back up a little bit. I think that Manet's need for approval goes back, maybe even, let's contextualize Manet's life for a second. His mother was like, you know, the daughter of a Swedish princess, and his dad was a French judge. I mean, they came from a lot of money. He was a little bit of an aristocrat. There was a massive amount of cash flow in his family. And that's interesting, right? So his dad doesn't want him to be a painter. His dad wants him to get into law, to, you know, want the job that will make you money, not the dead end career of a deadbeat painter. And so eventually his uncle like exposes him to it. I mean, like there's a journey there, but I feel like he never really got until later the approval of his dad. Perhaps that was part of his seeking. Like, and that's a recurring thing in his work. He's a true artist. He's always seeking, breaking. But yes. Okay. So they have the show across the street, and before Luncheon sur le Déjeuner, Luncheon on the Grass, there's a couple of really important paintings. Like, and he did it also, didn't he get into the Salon before that?
I believe he was in the Salon before for his more traditional paintings.
Yeah.
He's starting to experiment with subject matter, with flatness, with these ironic quotations of the Renaissance. And that was just seen as far too controversial for reasons that we'll get to.
Yeah. So he exhibits Luncheon sur le Déjeuner. It's completely outrageous. People feel like it's amazing to think about this now. Like, people were so disturbed. Like, if they didn't have the right security there, the painting would have been torn apart. People were appalled. And that's what you read, right? People were like, you can't think about that like that now. Cause like, it were so, you know, browbeaten with, you know, shocking everything. We see YouTube videos of people getting crushed, you know, and people dying every day. To us, it's like, wait, what? Why would they be offended by that paint? It's a paint. First of all, it's a painting. They were so offended by it. So
know,
we have to.
We're anesthetized to everything
we
now.
Are. And yeah. It's such a different, like, it just makes you think like, oh my God, what a different time. And then that brings me as an artist to like, oh my God, not to go off on a tangent, but oh my God, like if I had the amount of time to paint and not to, you know, deal with all this technology, but like, this was so appalling to people. They wanted to tear it apart. If he didn't have the right security there, they said that painting would have just been destroyed. That's how crazy it was.
I didn't know that. And especially just thinking about the painting, probably from our contemporary eyes, we would see it as completely anodyne. And really, it was not. And
can you explain anodyne to the viewers and myself, please?
Of course.
Just like, what, anodyne? There's like four words so far that I'm like, okay, I got to figure. What's anodyne?
Inoffensive.
Inoffensive, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, like, it really, to us, it's just, I could see where he's breaking the fourth wall. You have the main woman. Okay, tell me what's so shocking about the painting, right? The main woman is looking, breaking the fourth wall. She's looking directly at the viewer. She's naked. The perspective is completely bizarre. And yet there's a flatness, a graphicness to it, like an Erte or a Mocha. Later on, a Leyendecker or a Cornwell. And that's crazy. But at the same time, there's this classical element to it. Not only because technically speaking, it's painted in a classical way. There's a classical application of oil paints, but also there's a reference to Titian and his figures. You know what I mean? He's always going back to the great masters, the Titians, the Goyas, and grabbing and extracting compositions and figures. He's smart. He's stealing intelligently and changing it where no one knows.
Yeah, and he's well-educated, and that, like you say, and that probably comes from the privilege of his background, which I think is interesting because his subjects do not reflect that same positionality. And this painting in particular, it's a composition made up of four figures, two women, two men. They're in this pastoral setting. They're outdoors, and the men are clothed. They're wearing dark suits. And the suits would immediately alert a contemporary Parisian to their status as a flaneur or a dandy, this emerging middle class person who has this economic stability so that he can talk about life rather than participate in it. And the flaneur is a prominent reoccurrence in Impressionist paintings. So we see that here in Manet's proto-impressionistic composition. And then the women, surprisingly, they are nude. So we have these two clothed men engaged in some kind of dialogue, and then one nude woman and one woman in the back who looks almost like this classical Greek statue. And she is clothed, but it's in such a translucent gossamer that it clings so tightly to her body that it looks as though she's nude. And that, I think, was alarming to his contemporary viewers because especially this one woman who is confrontational, as you mentioned, she's the only figure who gazes directly out toward the viewer in almost an aggressive, certainly an assertive way. And that would have felt a little jarring because there was still this puritanical belief about nudity. And I think that's worth delving into a little bit because in the canon of Western art history, we have seen nudes again and again and again. And there was this one painting, funnily enough, it was submitted in the 1863 Salon. So not the rejected Salon, but the actual Salon. And it's of a Birth of Venus, this very large canvas by Cabanel of a nude woman. And yet this nude woman was so unfit for view that it wasn't even exhibited alongside. And so we have to ask, what about this nudity is so different from the nudity in the Cabanel or the nudity of a goddess or a figure from the Bible? And I've kind of given it away. It's the fact that she's not cloaked in the guise of the classical, the eternal, or the biblical. She is an everyday woman. And so it's not modest for her to be nude and for the viewer to have access to her body and for her to have access visually with the viewer. She looks at us right in the eye. And so I think that's one aspect that was very controversial.
It seemed like she took her clothes down too. Like she's got like her legs wrapped in cloth, but she's not wrapped in cloth. She's not really exposing anything. There's no flesh. There's no nipple. It's, you know, everything is profile, right? Besides her face is three quarter, but like, it's bizarre. And like, why is she naked? Well, we know that the subject of Manet, you know, his model was a prostitute, right? And she is recurring in a lot of his paintings. So I don't know if the public had knowledge of his subjects, but certainly the, like you say, the aggression of looking at the viewer, like I said, breaking the fourth wall, you know, a little bit of that moment where the director stops and the actor talks right to the camera and you're like, whoa, this is crazy. Like, you know, now all of a sudden, and that's this moment here. This is cinematic almost. She stops, she takes notice of the viewer. She's having a conversation. We get pulled in and we either get like really like blown away by it or really disgusted by it because it is, we've never seen, bizarrely enough, we've never seen anything like it, right? Like we just, it's amazing that it went all the way to 1863 before there was really breaking of the fourth wall. And so like, let's get into the perspective. There's a breaking of perspective here, right? Leonardo da Vinci is the father of atmospheric perspective, and then we have linear perspective. And yet he doesn't really seem to follow that. The lady in the background who looks like she's clamming, she looks like she's digging in water. I don't know what she's doing, right? Like she's planning something.
Second.
Yeah, she's clamming. She looks like she's clamming. I don't know what she's doing, but the point is like, she's smaller, but perspective-wise, it doesn't make sense. There's something that he does that's so modernistic where he takes a figure, and I hate to say this, but like almost photoshops her in where he doesn't finish it, right? Because he doesn't lose edges. He doesn't make her necessarily more atmospheric. Her darks are dark. Her lights are light, right? And he floats her on this gray path beyond, I don't know what. Is it forest? Is it water? Is it, I can't tell. It's so bizarre. And you look at it and you go, well, it's wrong from an artist's perspective, right? It's wrong. It's not on the plane. It's off plane. It's not in perspective, but it's right because it feels jarring, but not like where it bothers me. It doesn't bother me to ill effect. It makes me go, that's interesting. Wow. I never thought of that. That's so weird, but it works. And it's spiritual. I can't tell you why it works. It just fucking works.
And I think that you're trying to grapple with the perspective and seeing correctness maybe in the foreground with the still life and then something that's bizarre in the background. I think that perfectly describes the liminality of Manet's work because he is moving toward flatness. And the move toward flatness is truly the move toward modernity. If you think about the difference between a Da Vinci with perfect, precise perspective versus a Pollock, which is this all-over composition, there's no sense of depth intentionally, then this is on that journey. And the way that I understand it myself is correct perspective as a non-art maker. Correct perspective really goes from front to back. From the foreground to the background, it recedes backwards in space. And then flatness is almost like the composition is stacked on top of itself. And so it's up and down rather than front to back. And this work has both because he's not ever just one thing. You mentioned before his quotation of Titian, and this painting is actually a pretty similar composition to a Giorgione painting, which I think was attributed to Titian way back when, but now we know it's Giorgione. But he also quotes Titian in another painting that received tremendous controversy. And then he quotes Goya. So he certainly is looking backwards. We know that he has the ability to paint with that exactitude, but he's choosing not to. And I think that choice is so fascinating because we have to ask why. If he's not choosing to paint in a manner that's correct, what is accounting for this change and what does it tell us? And I believe that the energetic reason is just this move toward the modern. And this particular painting almost looks like a stage set where the front is realistic and then the back has just been descended from the sky. But I also think that there's a practical reason for this interest. And I think it's because of the advent and proliferation of photography. When photography came out as an art form in really the 1850s throughout Europe and especially in Paris, then I think it freed painters from needing to paint life exactly because the camera does that. The camera will capture a moment, so painters get to do something else. And I think that's why we see so much exploration in Manet's work and in the work of the Impressionists and all of the modern artists who follow. It's because they're freed from the superficial trappings of having to depict exactly the life that unfolds in front of them.
Special shout out to James McNeil Whistler's Symphony in White No. 1, which was also the most discussed painting at the Salon Show. And they made them both notorious, which is interesting.
I got to get tickets. What a good show.
No, but they say that in history, like you hear about these cosmic events that were like, oh, you should have been to that da-da-da concert when the Beatles played Shea Stadium or what. But this was one of those where in Paris, in the context of art history, they say that this was one of the most powerful, important shows of all time. And it left with a taste that Manet had become notorious. He had become notorious Manet. And it was really interesting, right? Because here he was, notorious, rejecting the Salon. He becomes the hit of the altar show, right? The counter show. It's like counter Art Basel. There's all these counter shows going on at Art Basel, right? And it's the same thing. He becomes the countercultural hero. But at the same time, he himself is rejecting Impressionism. He doesn't really feel like he's part of the Gauguin, Degas, Monet crew. He's the homie. They're friends. They're in the same circles. But maybe let's touch upon why he doesn't feel like he's really an impressionist. If you read Jansen, if you read Gardner, you read any book, they're always going to name him as an impressionist. They leave out his own sentiments about the movement.
Interesting. Well, he never exhibited with the Impressionists, so I'm surprised that he would be reduced in that way. I think that probably his interest in history and in the tropes of historical Renaissance paintings, I think that separates him from the Impressionists, because Impressionists, like the ones that you mentioned, they would go outside, experience a crisp fall day, and then paint that experience. But Manet is painting with some kind of symbolic intent, and he's trying to create narrative as opposed to recreating the world in an observational manner. And like we talked about, he painted in a studio, so he didn't adopt the techniques of the Impressionists. He didn't ever quite adopt the looseness of their brushstrokes. He doesn't care really about dappled light. So I think that he's less like the Impressionists than he is like them. I think what connects them is their interest in portraying contemporary Parisians, because the models for his Luncheon on the Grass, one was his brother, one was his brother-in-law, one was a sex worker that who knows how he knew, but they were people in the world. And that was something that the Impressionists responded to as well. But I do think that Manet was more tethered to traditionalism and expectations of composition and storytelling than the Impressionists ever were.
Well, I think from an art historical perspective, it allows teachers, curators, museums to categorize him. He's a little bit in his own lane, right? He's not Courbet, who, by the way, loved Manet. A lot of people did not like Manet. Courbet, one of the greatest painters of all time, by far, loved Manet, you know, as did a lot of writers like Zola. But I think he's a little bit of a throwback, right? Because he's grabbing from Titian and Goya, and he's kind of rolling in the realist world, because he's very good. I'm not going to say he's Jean-Dominique Ingres or even Edgar Degas draftsman, but he's very close. He's excellent. He's an excellent draftsman. He's a very solid painter. But yet his unfinishedness, you know, all the attributes you gave him, but plus there's kind of this unfinishedness that everybody hated or loved about his work, which makes him modernistic again. That brings him to the Impressionism zone, but he's not either or. He's kind of in his own lane. And then he's doing something with the flatness and the perspective that really no one's doing, because the Impressionists, yeah, of course, Monet's haystacks are completely impressionistic and capturing light and playing with temperature and value and keying the world in different ways, right? Light, 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 color, color, color. But the perspective is not being messed with. It's not being played with. Manet does do that, almost like a surrealist, to be honest. So he's kind of ahead of his time now here too. He's classical, he's impressionistic, but then he's a surrealist. Now, how are you going to teach that? Oh, people like yourself, right? Throw them in the category, throw them in the impressionistic soup. So that we talk about Toulouse-Lautrec and Georges Seurat, let's just throw in Manet. And that's fine, but I think he's more. That's what I'm saying. He, when looking back at Manet, I kind of felt more. I felt like he was beyond his time. And let's be real here. He was living not on his art. He was living on his father's inheritance, which allowed him to be free. He wasn't, you know, tethered to the chains and shackles of commissions like other artists were. He wasn't tethered to making sure he did this because he had to and he had a side hustle. You know, like I heard Rousseau was like a mailman and a painter at night. You ever hear that, Henri Rousseau?
No.
I mean, there's some crazy stories, like, you know, but like he really had the luxury and it didn't affect his work. I'm not making an excuse here. Like it didn't affect his work at all. To me, it added to the fact that he was able to do what he wanted to do and perhaps experiment.
Sure. It gave him room to maneuver, which obviously he is. He is playing with ideas in this creative and really innovative way. And probably his background, it gave him that allowance. And so I think it's important to note, but certainly not to judge. And I'm glad that you brought up Courbet, because he did support Manet, but not this one painting, Manet's Olympia, which I believe was painted in the same year as Luncheon on the Grass, so 1863. And this painting was seen as too controversial even for Courbet, who famously, as a feminist, my favorite of his paintings is Origins of the World, which is basically just a woman's vagina. Have you seen that painting?
I haven't.
Oh, it's fabulous.
must have seen it. How do I not know that?
But very unusual for the 1850s to just paint that. But
yeah.
Anyway, I digress.
I mean, he's throwing stones when he did that painting. That's weird.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I bring it up, because when I read about that, I thought, then what is so inflammatory about Manet's Olympia? So the composition is a direct reference to Titian's Venus of Urbino. Titian is a Venetian High Renaissance painter in Italy. And this painting, it shows a woman reclining.
1538.
Oh, very nice.
1538, he did that painting.
I'm impressed.
I mean, that's how much of a throwback he is.
Yeah. And Manet would have had access to art history. And so he knows because of his education. And the composition is quite similar. It depicts a woman who's nude, who's reclining in this, what would you even call that? Just a reclining couch? It's like a settee?
Yeah, it's like a, I don't know. Yeah.
And
it's something, and it's very odalesque-y, but odalesque, usually they're lying backwards and they're looking out, a la Jean-Dominique Ingres. Yeah.
Exactly, which is an... All of these paintings, I think, are compositionally references to each other. And instead of looking back, this woman, this Olympia, she looks directly at you. She is staring the viewer straight in the eyes. And there's another figure, an African woman in the background. She's bringing in a bouquet of very luxurious flowers. And then on the other side, we have this half-drawn curtain. And I bring that up only because that is such a theme in traditional portraiture in Europe and also in early portraiture in the United States, because they're trying to reference portraiture in Europe, but it's just a way of delineating space. It's the space of what's happening in the composition that's separate from the space of the viewer. Think of it like a play backdrop, or not a backdrop, but the curtain that separates the stage from the audience. And the fact that that curtain is here, it has no purpose in the scene other, I believe, than to just reference these more traditional paintings. And sorry for the beep, that is my son's monitor. The battery's out. So anyway, the woman, she's nude, she's engaging directly with the viewer. And we assume that she is a sex worker. Olympia was a way of describing women who were prostitutes at the time. And the bottom of her feet are dirty. And I
never noticed that.
Oh, yeah. You see that she's wearing sandals, but the fact that her feet are dirty was such an intentional painterly choice. And so he's letting us know who this woman is. And she seems completely unapologetic about what she does. And that sense of self-assuredness and that confidence in her body and in her choices, that would have been seen as a confrontation to being a correct lady in Paris at the time.
Those hands are painted so beautifully, and the placement of her hand on her leg is very promiscuous and very, perhaps for some, intoxicating, and definitely leading. And then, of course, there's a black cat at the end of her bed, which suggests, you know, the erotic and, you know, the feline, the sexuality, as opposed to the dog, which usually is indicative of loyalty. So, and there's something, once again, very classical about it. Very avant-garde. Just the composition is just so just bizarre. Like everything is, and yet the classical nature of the handling of the sheets is beautiful. It's painterly and it's experienced. You could feel the pressure of her arm, you know, laying into the cushion. It gives it, you could feel the gold, you could feel the pattern, you could feel everything. And the hands are really, really painted well. He was a good hand painter, which is a lot more than you could say for a lot of artists who are even in art history. It's just a weird, beautiful painting. And he captures you in between spaces to where you feel like, I don't even know why I love this so much because it's so bizarre. Right?
Like the hands are exquisite, but
beautiful.
Just the fact that you brought up the cat, I completely forgot that there was a cat in that. Yeah. And I think it's important to note that in the Titian Venus of Urbino, there's a dog sleeping next to
that's
her.
Right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And so these are all self-referential nods to history. And that's something that the Impressionists just don't do. So to get back to that discussion, but the dog in the Renaissance version, if that is suggesting the sexual loyalty of that sitter, then the cat is perhaps suggesting the sexual fluidity of this sitter. And whether viewers picked up on that or whether they knew that there was another painting that could serve as a companion, the fact that she's directly engaging the viewer, the fact that her feet are dirty, the woman who brings in flowers, we can only suspect that they're a gift from a patron. All of these little clues give us enough information visually that we know that we're looking at a woman that people in Paris at the time chose to perceive as invisible. And Manet brought her to the forefront. And the canvas is also quite large, which was unusual for a genre painting.
Yeah, you know, he was so, he was really malleable, like from the homeless guy, the absinthe drinker, you know, all the way up to a bar at the Folies Bergères. He's a deep and profound artist, and he's got a very short time span of life. He dies in his 50s. You know, he died of syphilis. I think he had his leg amputated, and then 11 days later he's dead, you know, so who knows what he would have created, because he was like, you know, he was like, a Picasso. He was always changing. He was always pivoting. He was always moving. He was always just growing. And I think it's fair to discuss, A Bar at the Folies Bergères. Are you?
Absolutely. I think before we stop, we need to talk about this painting.
Yes. This painting is wild. Honestly, it's just wild because you're looking directly at her, but you're seeing an angle that's not reflected as we look at the actual beautiful figure. And once again, the figure is breaking the fourth wall, staring at us. The characters in the background are handled very impressionistically. their reflections, right? The reflections of the mirror, but they're handled like a Toulouse-Lautrec painting. It really feels like a circus scene. I mean, it is the Folies Bergère, but it feels like a circus. It feels like these brushstrokes of crazy, wild light and people, and they're looking off with their binoculars and the abstraction of them. It's just really well done, as opposed to the foreground. And you see the delicacy, the classical nature that the flowers are handled in, that the orange in the glass are handled in. That's so beautifully classical. It almost feels like a Dutch master still life painting, right? And later on in his work, his last works were still lifes. He is obsessed with this classical mastery. And then you go to the figure. Okay, so he's got this incredible foreground of classical reference, the background of today, it's contemporary, it's modern, it's Toulouse-Lautrec, it's whimsical, it's wild. But then he has her. And I'm telling you, if you look, this is a sign of a good draftsman. If you look at the break of her wrist, because she's leaning on the bar, and if you look at the wrist to the hand, the understanding of, it's not anatomy, it's the understanding of the exact shape that makes it work. Because that's a very difficult shape to make work. From a painter's perspective, to do that the way he does is absolutely brilliant. Brilliant. You will not find any impressionist that's at his level of technicality, aside from Edgar Degas, who was a student of Jean-Dominique Ingres, who was a student of Jacques-Louis David. So of course you find it in Degas because he was a psychopathic draftsman. But you will not find Monet. You will not find Toulouse, Seurat, Gauguin, Van Gogh. You go down all the lists. Camille Claude, I don't care who it was. Nobody with that right there, the wrist to the hand, that there is an indication of how freaking good he was. And he plays with it. Now he's playing with you because he knows how to do that. He knows how to execute. Then he's got this crazy circle in abstract, like a moon, like a full moon, but it's just a device. I don't know what it is, actually. I think it's just an actual ornamentation on those pillars. But they feel like moons surrounding her, these two moons. It's such a weird device. It almost feels like...
Are there artificial lights? I'm not looking at the painting, but I know what you're talking about. It could be light.
Artificial lights. And then he's got chandeliers in the background. I mean, he's got this really abstract thing going on. And then the perspective is wrong. But by the way, he paints the wrist to the hand with such incomplete understanding and mastery, you know he's fucking with us. You know he's playing with perspective. Because if he could... He would, and he doesn't. He doesn't. I think, and that's intentional.
That point is brilliant, that intentionality, because this work was panned. People thought that the reflection in the mirror, since it was so skewed, that was a critical flaw of the work. And essentially, the composition is simple. We are looking at a woman behind a bar, and there's a mirror behind her. And so we see the reflection of the space behind us through the mirror. But then in the side, we see the profile of a man, but we don't see the actual body of the man. So that leads us to believe that we are the man. So we're the flaneur. We see our reflection in the mirror, but we shouldn't be able to see it in the way that we do, because then we would see our actual body as occupying space. So the reflected surfaces are all crazy. And the,
but they work.
But they work.
Yeah, they work. Because doing that, like as a painter, you could easily make that noisy and disgusting and hard to read and artificial and confusing, but he makes it work.
And I think what he also does is he invites the viewer into the environment in a way that is so smart. The flaneur is this reoccurring theme in a lot of paintings at the time. And now we're implicated in that. And the flaneur, it's all about voyeurism, the act of looking, scopophilia, the love of looking, the pleasure that one derives from that act. And now we are the ones who are looking. And we know that literally, if you're engaging with the painting, then you're looking at it. But he is almost saying, no, this is you. This is this voyeuristic male gaze that is impressing upon this female bartender, and that's you. And it makes me a little bit uncomfortable almost looking at this painting just because of the intimacy of that gaze and the fact that this mustachioed man is also me. And I love it. I think that it is such a smart painting, and it's also playful. He signs his name on a beer bottle in the lower left. And those, I think you mentioned the feet are just this circus atmosphere. We see green feet of a trapeze artist.
Oh, yes. Good call. Yeah. No, I didn't find the signature, but I found the trapeze artist. It's so weird. But I guess there was trapeze at the Folies Bergères, right? That makes so much sense. Everything's like a Cirque du Soleil in Paris. Like on a Sunday night, it's just normal.
So he's concealing certain things to us, and he's revealing others. And that dialectic of showing and hiding is so modern. And the fact that he's doing this in the late 1800s or the mid to late 1800s is really remarkable.
Yeah, he's, and this painting looks a lot like that Renoir painting. What's that Renoir that looks kind of like this?
Oh,
Renoir is an artist that we should discuss and then we should trash because he didn't really deserve to be part of, he didn't deserve to be part of it. But anyway, look, this is an important painting. He went on, he did so many important paintings. We're just basically scraping the surface. We talked about three of them, but just what an absolute brilliant, brilliant painter. I went from top 50. I think I'm top 10 now. I think this week he's my top 10. I mean, he might go back to my top 100, top 50, but this week he's top 10 because he's just that good. And an artist who can direct like that is like a conductor. He's orchestrating his own symphony. What an opus. There's some bands that have great songs and they, you know, they're flashing the pans, a hit song here and there. This guy is an absolute, he's created an opus. His oeuvre is completely deep and profound. Manet is one of the greatest painters we've ever had on earth. Thanks, Lizzie.
Yeah, thank you. This was such a treat as always. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back more in a scheduled manner than once every 6 months.
We're back, baby. Peace.